The text here, it's like the 1950s, everyone on about the young people this and the young people that. I'll just give a flavour. The younger people are responsible for the second wave. The older people supported the young people on gay marriage and abortion, and now their support is needed. And that goes on with some other sentiments about young people that I won't read out. Here's an idea. So you heard Carl Coleman's going to be talking about, should the influencers be talking to the young people? Here is an idea from Vincent, who emailed us to say that, Brendan, all week the media are on about influencers. May I suggest ways to get across to people? As we all know, we Irish love English soccer, beg your pardon. I think the government should get English Premiership managers to address the young people of Ireland about COVID, as they are the only ones they seem to listen to, as they're always on about how good their team are and all that. You know, they might believe Jurgen Klopp before Micheál Martin. And there's an interesting idea, but maybe we should start gathering all kinds of people who young people look up to. But would they listen? Who knows? Are they listening at all? Michael Harding, good afternoon. Michael, are you with
us? Good afternoon to you.
Michael, do you think the young people are listening at all?
I don't think they are, no. Really? I love the idea of the guards breaking up communion parties. That's a good idea. And I love the fellow who
said... And you see, they'd know the culprit that, straight away.
We voted for gay marriage. Now, yeah. Now, you should do something for us. This is funny, and you couldn't make it up, but really... One of your panelists said the truth. We are one community. We are one community, people. We are one humanity. And that's the way we'll get out of this, not by sectionalizing one crowd or another. The over 70s, the cocoons, which mixed with buffoon and baboon. But in actual fact, we're just over 70. I'm not over 70, but people are over 70, young people. We're all one community. And we all love each other. And loving each other is going to get us out of this.
Yeah. I'm speaking to you, I should say, to people apropos of you have a new book called What is Beautiful in the Sky. And it was kind of written in lockdown. It's not about lockdown. I suppose it's reflections on lots of stuff in your usual scraps of memories and memoir and everything. But I suppose the overarching arc of it is lockdown. There's a lot of meditations on that. At the beginning of the book, you take us back to March. And Michael, you say this thing, and I don't know, it struck me through the heart. In the course of the following 3 months, all that we were was taken. Do you think that's what happened? Yeah.
I think that COVID-19 is a real step change in human civilization. I think that the ramifications of it will only become clear in the next 20, 30, 40 years. The tiny little thing that COVID-19 is changes us socially. It changes us politically. It changes us educationally. It changes concepts of freedom. It changes absolutely everything. And generation who are born today will grow up with this. They will grow up with it as normal. Their face is taken away and they have a mask. That's a fundamental change that we couldn't imagine happening. And yet all this is happening and it's natural. Now it will become the new normal. Now there's two options of what... Either things will get darker, and they could get darker if you look at the kind of political scenarios in Europe and in Britain and in America or in Brazil, or they alternatively could get better. And I would be, as a person of faith, I would be a person who believes that there is an evolution happening in consciousness and that we're on the cusp of a real sense of our common humanity.
Michael, you're dropping slightly there. Is there anything you can do differently there? Are you on a Skype, yeah? Because I don't want to...
I'm on a Skype.
Yeah, it's just
Should
dropping...
Should I hold the phone, maybe?
It's just dropping slightly. Yeah. Okay, so what we'll do is we go to an ad break. We might try and get you back on a better line because I do want to talk to you, but I think it's quite irritating for people when it's dropping words, okay? So hold tough there. You're not going anywhere anyway, Michael, are you?
No, yeah, I'm stuck here.
Stay in the cocoon. We'll take a break and we'll try and improve the situation.
Email brendan@rte.ie.
Welcome back. Now, I'm talking to Michael Harding, ostensibly about his new book, What is Beautiful in the Sky. But with Michael Harding, the conversation is never what it's ostensibly meant to be about. Michael, are you with us now?
I am, yes.
Yeah, that sounds a bit better. Listen, before we go on with the weighty matters of the paradigm shift in the world, Ed here has texted in to say, I'm looking to buy a holiday home in Leitrim. Can you ask Michael, does he think Leitrim is a good county for this purpose?
It is, yeah. Of course it is.
Yeah.
It's a better county to live in, though. Why would you just come on holiday? Come and live in Leitrim. I'm looking out on our blue Loch Allen. It's astonishing. Listen, I won't go on about it. Come to Leitrim, definitely.
Okay, well, look, maybe if he starts holidaying down there, he'll get sucked in like other people do. You're looking at, towards the end of the book, you are going on one last great mad adventure, you and the beloved, and you're buying a house in Donegal.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like retirement stuff, you know? And I think that everybody has to have a heaven. Everybody has to have a dream. And I believe in heaven. It's like Paddy Kavanagh, I do not see a lion in the cold wet clay of a Monaghan graveyard. Even as an old person, you dream of heaven. And I dream of Donegal, I dream of the ocean, and I'd love to have a little house there. And it didn't work out for us 2 or 3 years ago. We're trying it at the minute. We're kind of there. And then the lockdown happened and we couldn't get there. But we get there someday.
And listen,
West Donegal, yeah.
You mentioned retirement. I'm having trouble conceptualising what it is you're retiring from, like, and what would you not? Do you not just do what you do anyway? Like, I'd say you can't help the old thinking, can you?
I think that sometimes, every time I write a book, I feel maybe this is the last book. Maybe now I'll retire. And you know, this book particularly, What is Beautiful in the Sky has been my lifetime choice. To not try and pick in your memory the stories that are the darkest, but try and pick something that's beautiful. And in the COVID, when I was here meditating on that, it seemed to me that is the one key thing that the whole of us in this island have to do now, is stop thinking about the negative and really work positively at what's beautiful. I wrote the book, I finished the book, and you always have that feeling that this will be the last one.
Okay, so that we should redirect our attention to the beautiful. But you do say then, which I thought, it's a beautiful thing to say, but slightly depressing in a way, that beauty is what we reach for, but we never find. In our little destinies, it eludes us. So, or then you say, are we simply overtaken by age and time? So beauty is an aspiration, but we'll never get there, will we?
Well, not in this life, Brendan, because this life is incomplete. And that's what makes us, as Heidegger would say, beings for death. We are orientated towards our own mortality. And when mortality comes, when the end of life comes, it is you have finished the masterpiece. You have completed the masterpiece. But the mysterious thing about death, it's like silence. It seems like it's completed in the anticipation of there being more. I know that's heavy stuff for a Sunday, but...
Not at all. Sunday's the only day you could do this kind of stuff. So do you think, does that mean, Michael?
We come at the end of life to a dream that we will be in heaven together. We will love each other forever. You cannot limit human love. It's kind of immeasurable. It goes on even beyond your own ego. And so when your own ego disintegrates, there's something of a greater consciousness is constantly gathering us up. And that's why beauty can never be completed in this life.
So will we always, while we're still alive, we'll always have a kind of a wanting in us, will we?
Yeah, I'd say a longing. A longing, like the old saints used to say, you know, our hearts are longing until they rest in the ultimate idea of God or consciousness or whatever you want. That listen to me, if you think you're happy, you're not happy. And the people who grasp and get, they say...
There's no winning, so is there?
I'll be happy if I get a BMW, the man says. Then he gets a BMW and he's totally irritated because there's no car play or something in it, you know?
Yeah.
We're never happy in this life. We're only happy if we let go and realise that the beauty that we long for is there and it's calling us. It's like a presence behind the veil of the world and it's calling us towards beauty. But we never really consume that until our life is over and complete. And then we're in there.
Yeah. So the latest answer to all your questions is going to be Donegal and being by the ocean, and then you'll get there and you realise that's not enough
exactly.
either. The last time I met you, you were kind of gone back to the Catholicism in a kind of an alarming way, but then you mentioned that you were looking to get into the Islam as well. Are you Buddhist, Catholic, or Islam at the moment?
I apologise for that. Yeah,
The last time I met you, you were quite like a tormented fundamentalist Catholic, I thought. I was quite concerned.
I was about 4 months away from the heart attack. I wasn't a well man.
Yeah.
But I would tell you this about Catholicism or Buddhism or whatever you have in yourself. It seems to me at this stage that we need to start using the side of our brain that does more than just name the world. You know, being rational and logical has helped us get to this stage in evolution, but it has also tormented us with the way that we have destroyed the planet. And unless we turn around and open our hearts more to the mystery of what is present, you can't save the trees by thinking about the trees. You need to start loving the trees and loving the cosmos. And in that situation, I think that all religions, Catholic, Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, and Islam, are hugely beneficial. They're like psychotherapies. That's all they are. But they will help you live a more full, imaginative life.
And I'm getting that you think that this current upset could be a kind of a bridge into that shift in consciousness.
I do. And I also think, to be honest with you, what I speak about is the religion as we know it, which is institutional, which is about creating codes of righteousness, moral codes of righteousness that people like, you know, churches think if everybody behaved like this, we'd all be righteous. And they missed the point that the wisdom teachers in every tradition said the opposite. They said, forget your righteousness, forget your laws, forget your codes, and love each other. Just open your heart to each other in a kind of sense of being there in the presence of love with the people around you. That's what works. So my interest in religion is to liberate people from the old style tyranny of institutional religions. I think they're appalling, they're disgusting, and they're nothing but bad. I think that it's a step change in consciousness that's beginning to open people's hearts to realise we need to do this differently. We need to just simply to find ways to love each other and to love the planet. That's hugely important.
Okay, now, on the personal side of things, I felt reading the book that keeps coming up, age and time and time passing and the kind of sadness and the melancholy of that as well. But yeah. I know you'll avoid this question, but you wrote it as a column at the time and it really stopped me in my tracks. And you talk about it again in the book about when your daughter went away to Australia with a young lad from Donegal. Tell me about that.
Well, my daughter went away to Australia, I forget when it was, 2 years ago maybe. Now, she ended up coming back quite soon, but when she was going to Australia, it seemed like the nest was empty, and I was devastated. And I just didn't know how it had happened that suddenly 25 or 20 years had passed, where the whole focus is the idea of being a parent, and then all of a sudden, one day, the young person says, I'm off to Melbourne. And you feel that you've nothing in your life anymore. Like everything in the garden that I looked at, the swing that she used to swing on, the little ball that she used to play with, they were there lying in the grass and the rushes. And the sense that there's nothing, there's no meaning in life, because my life's meaning was being a parent, being a father and loving and having joy with children. And it's gone. It's over. And I had to break through that because it's a devastating loneliness for people whose children have moved out of the nest. It's absolutely devastating. And the two things that you have to do, I think, one is to break through it and do something else. And it was 2 days after she went to Melbourne that I drove over to Mayo and bought a camper van. I said, feck this, I have to have a life.
Yeah.
Right? And the other thing that happened was that trust, you know, trust that the world will evolve okay. You hear people talking to you there about you know, young people should do this, that and the other. Don't worry about young people. Young people are magnificent, they're beautiful, and the boat will turn right side up and the world will go on, and young people will be there to love and help the older people. It's no problem. So my daughter, as it turned out, coincidentally, she went from Melbourne over to England. She was working in England for a while, and now she's back in Donegal. So get over yourself. She's up the road. And you do find older people, you know, indulging themselves in a kind of a whinge about the empty nest. And you'd say to them, well, where is your daughter? And they'd say, oh, she's down at the other side of the town. And you'd be thinking, but you see her every day then, so...
Michael, there are people whose children are in Australia and they feel very, very far away and they feel very far away right now.
Terribly far away at this point in time with COVID and the fact that people haven't got home for summer, they haven't got home for months and months and months, and it is devastating.
On the age and time, there's a very poignant portrayal in the book of your friend, the General, who your readers will know. And the General was always a kind of a bumptious, pull-yourself-together kind of character who he owned the space he was in, you felt. And very sad now, the General is weakened and he's in a home. He's kind of like a lion in winter now, isn't he?
He is. I track his story in the book a little bit and reference him without giving too much details, because the General, I've been writing about him for 20 years, and in some sense, he's a shadow. He's a ghost in everything I write. He's the last patriarch in the 20th century. He's like a strange, obvious man at a certain age. And he's a character that I have great fun with in my columns. But in this book, I do tell a story about trouble that happens to him in his health. And,
that's there.
And there's also a little glimpse into the General and why the General was the way he was. I wondered, was it a scrap from your own life, that the General, behind all of that kind of front, the General was damaged basically because he was led to believe when he was young that he wasn't kind of manly enough. So he got super manly.
Yeah. I've met a lot of men who carry with them the damage that was done by their parents, by fathers as well as mothers, and other writers like John McGahern have written about it. But one of the strange sadness is that I see sometimes is men who are actually damaged in their childhood and then become damaging to other people. In other words, the brutality of a father can sometimes hurt somebody so much that they try to be brutal themselves because they're so terrified of being vulnerable. And it's probably particularly from male to male. And I think that I was lucky. My father was, he was old when he married. He was a very gentle and poetic kind of creature who was really encouraging me in being a writer and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, the General to me, as I say in the book, he's a shadow that is in my life always. And I think every man has a shadow, if you like, the kind of patriarchal, misogynistic, old-fashioned male who thinks he can have everything the way he wants it and doesn't really get women.
Yeah.
And I think the General is that kind of person. He's based on a very real person who lovingly enjoyed for a laugh when I was writing. But he's also, I like to bring him in to have him as my shadow in anything I write.
You say about your father, I suppose the damage that was done to you, if there was any, it was more Nelly, your mother in a way, even though she didn't mean to, and you don't hold it against her or anything, but that's possibly where your issues stem from, is it?
Well, it's I've gone round the circle on, you know, whether you call the experience of childhood damage or not. And I don't know, to be honest with you. I mean, my mother, I couldn't be a storyteller without my mother. I couldn't be who I am without my mother. I couldn't be alive without my mother. So many of the kind of personality traits I have, I know, are absolutely the spit of horror.
And sometimes even as I get older, when I look in the mirror, I can see my mother. So my journey in life has been to share in my books the kind of fractured relationship that I had with her. But I think that that's not necessarily her doing damage to me. Mm. I think that's just the human condition. We do bump up against each other and make mistakes. We are terribly fragile. And the passion with which my mother loved me and how it failed to get across is not a sense of damage. It's a sense of the human frailty that is in her and me. And I have to say, the older I get, the more she is a warm kind of image. I think of her in Donegal because she used to go to Donegal for 2 weeks every summer when she was a child. Like everybody in Cavan went to Bundoran for their holidays. And my granny would take a house in Donegal for 4 weeks, and she'd take up her daughters for 2 weeks and her sons for 2 weeks. And my mother, all my life, when I'd be going to Donegal with her as a child, she'd be going around saying, oh, this is where we used to have our ice creams when we were young. Mm. And that kind of sense of my mother as a young girl. Recently, I saw two or three photographs of her when she was working in Cork, and she was only like in her 20s. And she looks so young and beautiful and joyful. And I just feel that no matter what frailty or even damage there is in relationships, there's no relationship without it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's where you make mistakes in a relationship that allow you to be more human, because you're able to see it, you're able to forgive, you're able to ask forgiveness. You know,
none
of us are perfect.
And you're going back to Donegal now.
Am I going back?
And you are going back to Donegal.
If they let me in.
That's where you're looking at ending up. Listen, in the real world, there's lots of little vignettes in the book about life in lockdown and everything. You know, little stories, because that's what you do. As you say yourself, you trade in gossip in a way. You mentioned one lady, and I thought it was very poignant in terms of the whole... I can sense... in the book there's a slight anger about the cocooning, and you're not blaming anyone again, but it's just that it was rough on old people. That lady in her 80s that you know, she lives alone, and you talk about her life before the lockdown and the little connections and everything. Tell us about her.
Well, I think that again, even like going back to my mother, but I mean, I got a great insight into women of an elderly age because of the fact that my mother lived till she was 96. And I remember so frequently going to places like the Dunn stores or Tesco's or the supermarkets. And my mother would be there, but other elderly ladies would be there as well. And they had terribly, terribly small lives. And their weekly sojourn to the supermarket was and is hugely important. And the relationship they had, you'd see the girls in Dunn stores and they knew everybody's name. The old lady would come up and they'd say, how are you today, Sarah? Oh, not too bad. And they'd be patient and they'd be slow and people in the queue behind them would wait for them. And you'd see them getting out the little pennies. I think sometimes that you'll see an elderly person doing, because they're short of money, so that, you know, they're not, maybe they don't have the card to press the automatic thing, and maybe they don't have a £20 note. So they put a fiver down, and then they put another €2 down, and then they're doing the pennies. And it's taken a long while, and that kind of patience that we say the woman at the till is having with the elderly lady, that's a very, very beautiful thing to see. And in the lockdown, there's times where you'd be afraid that in the isolation of lockdown and everybody in masks, the world has got very, very difficult for old people. And that's why I was on about the word cocooning, because I think that labelling is libelling, and in some sense, you know, cocoon is just subliminally connected with pejorative words, and it would be better. I think that elderly people, it's good that we stay under restrictions sometimes and be very careful of going out, but just it was the word cocoon seemed to me a foolish choice of a word, And whatever advisor thought it up wasn't worth the 70,000 euros.
Actually, look, and yeah, I think all the politicians were actually kind of distancing themselves from the word as soon as it came out.
Yeah, it was just a bad word.
But I know you're not elderly yourself by a long shot, but at the same time, you were very careful during it. Did the isolation get to you, and did the lockdown get, like, let's forget the societal and the broader metaphysical issues, just in terms of you day to day?
In terms of me day to day, I had the months here in the beautiful weather, in the garden and in my studio, and it was really, I found it one of the most beautiful, serene 3 months of my life. And that's why I wrote the book. And that's why it's the one book that I passionately feel has a clear position from my point to choose what is beautiful. Because even in the lockdown, or if the COVID thing gets worse and we go through a terrible winter, there is something amazing about this thing. Let your heart open to the people who are around you. Work at loving others. It's the way out of this. And that's what I felt in the lockdown, and that's why I wrote the book.
Okay, Michael, thank you very much. And Michael Harding's book, What is Beautiful in the Sky, is published by Hachette Books Ireland, and it's out now. And Michael, you've a podcast as well. A few people texting in here to say that they love your podcast, and that can be found on patreon.com at Harding Michael. Listen, there's lots of texts in from people having these. I'll tell you what, Michael Harding, these are very metaphysical, philosophical texts to be coming into 51551 compared to the usual stuff we get. But there's one here, and I'm just going to say it to you now, and it'll jinx you completely. Brendan, this is from Peter. I firmly believe that man has attained enlightenment, and I'm wishing many, many years ahead of happiness. Was there ever a greater curse put on anyone by anyone?
No,
by that
come
text?
Here to me. Wait, I'm going to tell you something, Brendan, if you give me 30 seconds.
Go on.
That man is right.
You're enlightened, are you?
Yeah, but what he's missing is that everybody is. We don't need the institutions to set codes of righteousness. You need to just be here now and awaken to the people around you or the animals around you and let the tears fall from your eyes as you realise this is heaven. You are enlightened.
Michael Harding, it's always an absolute pleasure. This is heaven. Let's take a break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.